Hey there, Yag here. Before we jump into the show today, I have some exciting news to share. As of this month, we are officially part of the HubSpot Podcast Network. This means we are now part of the leading B2B podcast network designed to help professionals like you get inspired, learn, and grow. The ABM Conversations podcast is now alongside other great podcasts like My First Million with Sam Parr and Sean Puri, The Salesman with Will Barron, and I Digress with Troy Sandridge. Check out all these shows and more at HubSpot.com/podcast network. And now to the show.
Welcome to the ABM Conversations Podcast, the number one podcast for B2B marketers wanting to explore timeless account-based marketing strategies to drive revenue, customer engagement, retention, and everything that makes sense to both marketers and sales folks. No more fluff. No more vanity metrics. Live from India, made for the world.
Hello and welcome to another brand new episode of the ABM Conversations podcast. And this is me, your host Yag. In today's episode, we are going to discuss GTM, that is, go-to-market, and possibly get a method to the madness. When I sound this confident about a topic that everyone has different opinions on, it means we have someone with us who has built a clear go-to-market framework that we can execute. Today, we have with us my good friend, the ABM Superman, Sangram Majre. Sangram is the chief evangelist and co-founder of Terminus, the leader in ABM. He is the host of the Flip My Funnel podcast, which is among the top 50 marketing podcasts globally. He, along with Judd, is the host of the Peak Community, which is an invite-only private community for marketers and marketing leaders to get 1% better each week. Today, Sangram is going to unpack GTM for us and show how to put the MOVE framework to action. So time to get moving. Sangram, welcome to the show, and I'm super happy to have you here.
Yag, it's fantastic. Appreciate the intro. And what's exciting about this is, as you said, everybody knows what GTM in their head is. But as we will unpack, I think hopefully we'll get people thinking about it a little differently than what they may have come in listening to this right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is a historic moment for our podcast as well, because you are the first guest to appear more than once on the show.
Oh my God, that means I have a lot to talk about. Doesn't mean everybody is there to listen. So I appreciate that.
No, I'm absolutely going to love this. Right. So let's get started. First things first, like product marketing and ABM, go-to-market is one of those topics where everyone seems to have a definition of what it is. And some of them define it as, you know, how you take a new product to the market, while some others define it as the path to recurring revenue. So according to you, what is GTM in simple terms, and what is it that makes it so hard?
Yeah, well first of all, I'll give you the definition that Brian Halligan, who was the CEO of HubSpot when I interviewed him, and now is the executive chairman of HubSpot. And again, for people who know HubSpot know that they are, oh, that's a public company, over 100,000 customers. And I asked Brian, who owns go-to-market? So yeah, the very first time I heard this, and I was shocked, and I didn't believe it until I verified it with multiple different CEOs. He said, I own it. And I'm like, Brian, you're a CEO of a public company. You have 100,000 plus customers. You're closing million-dollar deals. Like, there's no way that you're also owning. Now, of course, the buck stops at CEO. That's what you mean. I get it. But he's like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I own only three things as a CEO. I own the vision for the company, because I have to constantly iterate where we're going. Number two, I own the culture of the company. If you don't have the right people, we are not going to build anything of any difference maker. And number three, which is not talked about, which is unsexy, which is not something that you will see me or others just talk about it on keynote stages, is go to market. And he defined it, which is the roundabout way to get to the answer to your question. He defined it probably the most eloquently than anybody else. And there's a bigger definition in the book. I can go through that in a second. But really, he defined go-to-market as a product.
Wow.
He said, yeah, Sangram, this is not a strategy. This is not a vision casting thing. It is not something you go over the weekend with your executive team and come up with it. that vision, that is overall where we go. That's not go-to-market. Go-to-market is a product, which means it's an iterative process to figure out what works, what doesn't work. And there are many, many facets, which is why he kept saying that CEO owns it, and he really means it when he says he owns it.
Right, right. That makes a lot of sense. And what does he mean by saying that it is a product? You know, that's something that I've not heard anybody else say.
Yeah, and I put that as a quote on the back of the book because it was such a defining moment in the research for this book. And his biggest pet peeve was people called go-to-market strategy. And he's like, it is not a strategy. You know, you have different types of go-to-markets, right? Like company can have a sales-led, where very heavy sales process. Or some, and you and I have talked about it and heard about it, which is product-led growth, which is like Calendly, which is a scheduling app. It's a product-led. The product speaks for itself, and everybody, every time they go to sleep and wake up, there are 100 more customers. That's a product-led thing. Another way to go about it is category-led, which is what we did with Terminus when we think about ABM. So in his view, like, look, there are many ways to go to market. But one thing that people have to think about is that it's an iterative process. Every week, he would think about stuff like, should we be acquiring another company? Should we be opening a new geolocations? Should we be hiring a salesperson? Or in their case, should we be focused on building agency partner program where 40% of the revenue really comes from that? Should we be partnering up with somebody? So that's what go-to-market really is. It's way broader than launching a new product. You're constantly thinking about how do I expand our business? Like that's the notion around that. How do I expand my business? And you think about that, regardless of what it is, a CEO is best positioned to think about it. And those decisions are really made literally week to week basis. It could change. One week you could say, you know what, we need to go in EMEA. The next week you would say, you know what, that's not working. Maybe we should acquire this company that we're partnering up with. And that level of agility and decision-making is what a product would do, right? Like your products, everybody's coding in it and they're changing. You're pushing different code bases every week for enhancements and features. You keep adding incrementally so that over a period of time, it will have an exponential impact. And that's really where he was going with. Think about go-to-market as a product. Meaning, do not settle on one thing and say, hey, this is our year-long go-to-market, quote-unquote, strategy. Start somewhere, absolutely have to start somewhere, but be very open to iterate on it every single week or month.
Absolutely love this. You know, this one statement that look at GTM as a product, it changes everything. You know, it changes the way you look and approach the entire process. And in your book, Move, you know, you talk about a set of 6 truth bombs about GTM. So would you mind taking us through it? I think that will set the table for us to get into the actual framework.
Oh, totally, man. You know, one of the things before we get there is, well, why is this topic important? I think that was one of your questions. And I want to point people out to, if you go and research SaaS Valley of Death and look for commentary on it, you will see a bunch of articles around that. And where what happens is, companies start and they get to a million, get to 5, get to 10, and it's all hard. But after 10 million, one might think, oh, I got this, right? You know, we have product running, we have salespeople, we are closing deals, 10 million, that's a major milestone, and it is. But after that, if you read those articles, there are studies from McKinsey and studies from Saster and studies from all these different research and HBR, you will see that after 10 million, you enter what is very well known in the SaaS industry as Valley of Death, meaning you literally enter 10 million and everything breaks. And a lot of organizations never recover from it between 10 and 50. So I think the stat is somewhere like 0.04% of the companies even make over 10 million and even cross the Valley of Death, which means you literally go to 10 million to die, right? And the research outlines saying that it's not because your vision all of a sudden became outdated. It's not because your team all of a sudden you can't hire great people. The big reason is at this juncture as a company, you evolve your product, you evolve your team, you evolve all these things which a lot of companies fail to evolve go to market. And that really is the crux, the reason this book exists is to help companies navigate. You can't avoid it. You can't just jump over it. You have to go through this. But this book will help you navigate the valley of death, because it is everything changes when you hit 10 million from a product, market, competitors, channels, your maturity, your pricing, everything changes at that. So I wanted to bring that up, Jörg, because I think people need to know why this is important.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Awesome. So just to follow on that, you know, when you think one of the things that we talk about, there are several, there are like six, truth bombs, if you will, as we talked about in the book. One of the truth bombs that we talked about was this idea that, you know, you need to think about your customer success, because that's not something most companies even consider part of the go-to-market team. So one of those things that we call in the book is that, look, your revenue team has a new roommate. That's our truth number two, which is revenue team. A lot of people think it's just a sales team. A lot of things, you know, maybe if you're doing ABM, you might consider marketing and sales being one team. You know, I've talked about that a lot, and that's great. Well, what's interesting is, and this is what Jeffrey Moore, who wrote Crossing the Chasm, really inspired this part of it, where he said, look, if you do not have customer success, not just part of your revenue team, but literally leading your revenue team, you will never achieve what we call in the book platform market fit. So let me pull that up a little bit. In our book, initially, what we had was sales plus marketing plus customer success. Based on that conversation, we changed it. So as you have the book now, you will see that customer success is before sales and marketing. And he's like, that is so important, because your organization would never achieve the proverbial platform market fit, which we can go through 3 P's if you want. If you would never enter into it, because if your CS team is not on the same page, you'll have what we all know is called the leaky bucket, where you get your top line revenue keeps growing because you just figured that part out, but your bottom line is just not working out and your retention tanks. And great companies are not based on acquisition. Great companies are based on retention.
Absolutely, absolutely. Can't agree more. You know, I talk about this from a RevOps and deal intelligence standpoint, and it's something that I often see, that people think that, hey, you know, when you talk of revenue teams, you often talk of marketing and sales, but always, you know, customer success and customer support are two areas that you just cannot miss out. I can't agree more with you on that. Absolutely love you for bringing this. Right. So, before we also go into the framework, I also wanted to do some more context setting. You know, the approach to GTM cannot be the same for companies of different stages, as you just said, because there are different maturity curves. So it all starts with, say, understanding where an organization is in terms of their product and the product's market maturity and all of that. So what are some of the common stages of market maturity that you often see? And how do you approach these transformation across these stages?
Well, that's a great question, Jörg. You know, it's funny. In the book, we wrote the book almost 80% of the way based on the MOVE framework. And we thought we got this. And then as we had these conversations with Nick Mehta, the CEO of Gainside, and Brian, the CEO of HubSpot, Manny, CEO of Outreach, and VCs and CROs, we realized we just missed the entire, as you said, the context of the stage of the business. Because the CEO owns it, the first question they actually are asking in their head, and they may not verbalize it this way, but in many ways that's what they're thinking about, is where am I? Like, what stage of the business am I in? And that's so we literally went back and redid the order of the book and put this ahead in the book. We call it the 3 P's go-to-market business transformation stages. The 3 P's really stands for problem market fit, product market fit, and it's something we talked about a minute ago, which is platform market fit. So think about problem market fit as a place where you're trying to figure out if the problem real and is the market big enough. A lot of times, my hypothesis really was that, well, that's like ideation stage, like early stage, you're trying to figure out maybe, you know, your 10 customers or something like that. What's interesting, what our research showed, Jörg, was that you could be a $20 million company and still be in a problem market fit.
Wow. How does that work? Like, just if you can give an example.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Think about it from this perspective. You could actually have great top line growth, but the reason you haven't moved or matured to product market fit is because you still haven't figured out what is a singular use case that can be repeated so that you can just add more salespeople or add more agencies or add more OEM partners or add whatever it is in order for your business to grow. So what you grow is your top line. What you do is you do unbelievable things to create big deals in the marketplace, but you're still not able to sustain and retain the customers. There are a lot of companies. That is why it's called the Valley of Death, is because you get to 20 million and die because you haven't figured out your go-to-market. And one of the kicker there is the area that we touched on earlier in our conversation is, instead of being a $20 million company and trying top-line revenue growth, a better result would be a $10 million company with 100% net retention rate. Now, that is a much more attractive business with a higher valuation, and it would push you into a product market fit arena. But I've seen over and over again, great name, great brand, a lot of noise in the marketplace, and then all of a sudden, they're just gone. Like, there's nowhere to be found.
Right.
So that takes us from problem to product. Now, product market fit is, you know, I think most of us recognize it. It's just a repeatable, scalable process. You just know that that use case makes sense. And what pushes, what happens at this stage, what requires at this stage is that you think everything is working. A lot of times, this is the $10, $20 million business that you see out there. But what happens at this stage is that you have reached a point where you're going to have a market, clearly defined market. You now have competitors. You're now going to have your existing customers asking more of you. You're going to have pricing pressures. You're going to have requests that requires you to push and do different types of use cases. So inevitably, companies have to now move from what we call product market fit to platform market fit, which probably is a very new term to a lot of people, because it means that you're now going from a single product selling solution to a multi-product, which makes it a platform, or multi-services if you're in a services business. And then what's interesting about this, Yag, is your market also expands. So let me give you a couple of examples that might help people to think through this.
Sure.
Think about HubSpot, right? Like HubSpot, since we use that as an example, and Brian is a good friend, and we have his quote in the book, they started with SMB owners and marketing, right? Like that was what they did in 2008, 2009. Then that was a problem market fit. Then they figured out in about 2010 that, oh, marketing automation is the thing that they have to anchor on. That was the product, because Spotlight was there, Marketo was coming out, Eloqua was gaining momentum. So they said they were going to be the marketing automation for SMB. And that really is where they got their grip on everything. They were a very high churn business before that. And then now we all know they're a platform market, because now they are servicing all the clouds, right? Marketing cloud, sales cloud, customer success, all that stuff. So that's a platform. But you can just take even a B2C example. Think about newsletters like Morning Brew or Skim that you and a lot of the audience may be familiar with. They started with a clear problem, saying, we're going to try to solve a problem for millennials who want to read Wall Street Journal, but they don't like the way it's written. So we're going to create a newsletter that's written like millennials and many of us want to read, and pull it together with business and life together. By 2018, they became a $3 million business with just one business-only newsletter with 6 million plus subscribers by 2018. Well, that was a product market fit. Just see the same correlation there. One product, that's all they focused on. And now in 2020, plus they're a 25 million plus company with marketing newsletter, tech newsletter, retail newsletter, business newsletter. So they expanded. You think about McDonald's, right? A lot of people know McDonald's is it's a global brand. In 1940s, they started with barbecue to orange juice in 1940. Can you imagine McDonald's having all that stuff? And then in 1948, they did a study that showed that, oh, most people only eat hamburgers, fries, and soda, which is probably the reason for obesity in majority of the world. But that's what people eat. So they shut down McDonald's in 1948, and they said, you know what? We're literally going to have these three things on our menu, and we'll have a couple of other things, but that's all we're going to sell. Well, guess what? That changed the way McDonald's, that was the product market fit, and now obviously they're a $150 billion plus company. So this is a B2B, B2C, across the board process of going through different stages of the business, but you can't leapfrog them. You have to walk through the problem, product, and platform market fit.
Absolutely love these examples. And another thing that comes to my mind is the way Salesforce has grown over the years. You know, that's again, I think, falling into the pattern, if I'm not wrong.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I'm glad you brought that up, Jaak, because Salesforce, I mean, think about Mark Benioff and the amount of buzz that he was able to create and building the SaaS industry or cloud industry completely. But for about 10 years, I think it's 12, if I'm not mistaken, but about 12 years, they focused on purely one thing, which is Sales Cloud. We are a CRM product for sales persona. They never moved away from that until they acquired ExactTarget, my previous company that I was part of through the Paradigm acquisition. And then they got into Marketing Cloud. And now they're into the Service Cloud and then Customer Success Cloud and all the different clouds out there. But man, they never ever, like almost for 12 years, people ask them, why are you not going into other things? And it's like, no, we need to own this market, 85% or over. And that's when they move to other markets.
Absolutely, absolutely. And now they even own Slack and all of that as well, the communication side of things.
Yeah.
Amazing. So it's now time for us to go into the actual go-to-market framework. So give us a good overview about what is this four-question framework, what does MOVE stand for, and at what stage should someone start considering using this framework?
So this is a framework that I believe could be applied at all stages, but the questions that I'm about to share are the same questions, but the answers to those questions are different based on the stage. And I can walk through that fairly quickly so people get a glance of it. And then again, people can go and download all these frameworks without even email, like literally go and download if you want from the movebook.com. You can download the scorecards for go-to-market, templates, all this stuff just available over there.
Just a little shout out here. You know, I have the book and there are these templates that are absolutely spot on. I wish I had got these things a few years back so that I could have been a little more smarter.
Dude, we all do. We all do. And this is, again, so much of this has come from, as you rightly gave shout out to the Peak community, you and others have made this book better. A lot of it is literally me collecting information. The go-to-market scorecard is what Mallory uses at Terminus for the last 2 years. I've seen it work over and over again. So the reason I'm sharing it out so openly and freely is because I got access to it, and it changed the way I run our business. And I'm like, well, you know, people need to know this because I don't want more businesses to fall into valley of death and not know how to navigate. So go to movebook.com, themovebook.com, and you'll see it. So back to the questions. What's interesting about this, Jaak, is we started with about 50 questions around go-to-market. And in our research, like 50 plus questions. And we asked these questions through forums, through polls, through actual one-on-one conversations with so many different people. There are like over 200 people that we actually went through the research, actual interviews, of different ways. And what we found out was it all came down to, when we pulled all the research together, it came down to four questions that every CEO, every leader asked, regardless of the stage of the business. And that really ended up becoming the MOVE framework, hence the name MOVE, and helping companies find what their next MOVE needs to be. So the four questions really, the MOVE stands for market, operations, velocity, and expansion. Market, operations, velocity, and expansion. And the questions are very simple. Like, you know, when you hear this, you wouldn't, none of this is like rocket science. Like, I'm not, none of this is genius. Like, this is very much helping you have a vocabulary that you may be asking around, but instead of just having a tangential conversation, this will help you focus on how to look at it. So the questions really are, market is really, who should you market to? Now, that doesn't change. The question stays the same, the answer changes. So what changes? In a problem market fit, you might be looking at TAM, right? Total addressable market. But in a product market fit, the same question, who should you market, would change to segments. You're talking about relevant markets. We call it TRM in the book, total relevant market. What specific use case do we solve and which market can we penetrate? And then in a platform market fit, the same question's answer is going to be, well, who should you market? And it's going to be around cohorts. Now, cohorts, not any cohorts, customer cohorts, because this is where, if you're a platform market fit, that means you have more than one product, that means you have a bigger market to go after, you are looking at the best customers that are giving you the most value. So you're not even looking at your entire customers to look at your NRR, your net retention rate. You're looking at a cohort of customers and building similar cohorts of customers. And that's really what gets the value. So that's just a flavor of one of these things. I won't go through each one of them in detail, but if you just think about that as a cross-section, question remains the same, answers are different. The second one is operations. This is where you go from literally being ad hoc operations to revenue operations as you get into to platform market fit. Velocity, this is the question everybody asks. When can we scale your business? Like, when can we scale our business? This is where you start thinking about, well, not just reactive, but actually prioritizing your initiatives out there. And then finally, the expansion question. This is what we got from Scott Dorsey, who's the CEO of ExactTarget. They went public, and then they actually went private as they got acquired and stuff. And then what was interesting about them was they said, well, Scott says, like, hey, look, what keeps me up at night when I think about the days back in the ExactTarget days was, where can we grow the most? What area do I grow our business the most? There's so many options. There's so many ways. And this is where you really think about, are you going to grow with a sales team? Are you going to grow with agency model? Something we talked about is, are we going to grow as an OEM model, as a partner model? Are we going to build an AppExchange style ecosystem around it? What are we going to do in order for us to create expansion for our business? So those four questions, I was very, very, very happy when it came down to four questions, even more happy when it became an acronym, and recognizing that, look, you are at a different stage. It's okay to be in a problem market fit. It's okay to be in a product market fit or platform market fit. The point is not to push you unnaturally. But if you don't know what questions to ask, a lot of times we will go and try to anchor ourselves to the wrong answer. And that is what causes people to die faster in the valley of death. Like, no, if you're a problem market fit, stay there. The metrics and the scorecards are different for it. And we have that in the book. There's a completely different scorecard for a problem market fit company over a platform market fit company.
I think it's a good time to take a moment and thank the HubSpot Podcast Network. Being part of the HubSpot Podcast Network means we now have a behind the scenes look into the world's number one CRM platform and get to share new information and features that are helping businesses like yours stay connected to their customers, goals, and teams. With improved forecasting tools and custom report builders, you can see how your quarter is going, inspect new deals, and use customizable data-driven reports to improve team performance as you grow. With custom behavioral events, you can track site behavior and understand your customers' buying habits all within the platform. And if you're looking for cleaner data, with a centralized system, the all-new Operations Hub Enterprise gives your ops leads the ability to curate datasets for all users, meaning even faster and more consistent reporting. Learn more about how the HubSpot CRM platform can help connect the dots for your business at HubSpot.com. You know, this absolutely sounds so easy and, how did I not think of it when you look at it in retrospect? But until somebody puts it into a framework and presents you, you know, it's very Richard Feynman-like, right? You know, it's like six easy pieces, or here it's four easy pieces, but somebody had to put it together.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I keep telling to myself, and it's me and my co-author, Brian, we went through this, is like, you know, when the book is finished, and you've written books, so you recognize this, is like, when you're done, you're like, man, you know, I hope nobody looks at this and says, we already knew that. Like, you know, because again, none of these questions are like earth-shatteringly like, oh my God, I never thought who should be my. Of course, people have thought about it. But what was an aha moment for us, Yag, in this was that the questions are the same, but the answers are different. And I think, I hope people really take that to heart. I hope companies and leaders in the companies really look at that and recognize that it is totally okay to be in one of these stages of the business. It's not bucketing you in one. You're not cornering yourself into one. It is actually self-realization, if you will, of where you are as a business, and then recognizing what metrics you should really focus on. It will really help take away the stress that we all put on ourselves to try to be something we're not. Like, all of a sudden people look at a Saster blog and they talk about all these, like, you know, like a lot, somebody might be listening and say, I don't track NRR, I don't track GRR. Well, that's okay. Maybe you're in a problem market fit and your scorecard is going to not be about NRR. You don't even have enough customers to do that. So don't even try to track something just because it's an obsessor blog or anything like that. You need to focus on what stage you're in and really, really care to the customer base. And that will really help your company. A lot of times, the excitement of trying to move to a different stage is high enough where you try to leapfrog it. And my great encouragement to everyone is, don't try to leapfrog this. This is a walkway, or this is a staircase. You have to walk the stairs. You have to do the hard work. This is only going to help you navigate it.
So if in this case, like, why do we often see that, you know, when it comes to companies, as companies grow, we see leadership people changing over a period of time. The people who grew the company from 1 million to 5 million are not the ones that generally take them to 50 million. So why is there a leadership change if people can stick to the basics here?
It's a very good question. You know, once somebody asked me this question, Sangram, are you growing at the rate your company is growing?
Right.
And I'll challenge everybody listening to this to ask themselves that question. And the answer to that question for me, Yag, was no. I wasn't growing at the rate my company was. Our company at one point, you know, in the early stage, because the numbers are so small, like we went from 0 to 1 million in the first year, 1 million to 5 million in the second year, 5 to 15 million in the third year, right? Like, so you think about the growth trajectory of our company in the first just 2 years, like, I mean, you know, there's no way humanly I'm growing that fast. And I think it was a realization for me, which is why I changed my role in my own organization to say, you know what, we have to find leaders who actually can understand this part of it, and more importantly, get excited about this part of it. So for me, building something new, birthing something new, creating something new is where I get all my energy and passion. You sit me down for another compensation plan for a sales org, and it, like, you know, it would just blow my mind, right? You're just like, oh my God, I can't do that anymore. But some people are so excited about it that if you take that away from that, it will be a sin. So it's in many ways, I think it is realization of this fact that asking yourself and being true to yourself, are you growing as fast as your organization? And if you are, then great, you will actually be rewarded for it. And I think a lot of people do grow with the organization as it grows. But for some, it is hard to be excited about the movement, even though the company is moving. Is like, there are certain areas that you just can't. Finding your lane of genius and staying at it is absolutely a good thing. There's no problem. A lot of companies, you for example, a CMO at one company would think, oh, if you're a CMO, are you good to be a CMO at every company? Absolutely not. You might be a great CMO for startup companies, but if I put that CMO in a publicly traded company, or, you know, that person would be like, man, I can't do anything without going through legal, right? It would be so hard for them to be a great CMO. So I don't think it's a kick on somebody's ability to grow. It's more of realizing I can grow at a certain rate. I can be in my lane of genius, and this is my lane of genius. You realize that, and I think you'll be a lot more excited about whatever role you're playing in that organization.
You know, what you said absolutely resonates with me a lot, because I've always personally enjoyed working in startups and companies under the 10 million range, because I'm a builder. But if you put me into a very process-oriented organization and say that these are the 5 things I want you to do day in and day out, I'm like, no, that's not working for me.
Right. And I would submit to you, Yag, that you will, if you were forced to do that for one unfortunate reasons, but let's say you were forced to do that, you'll be able to do it well. You will be able to probably do it better than most people, because you understand that world better. But it will still not bring joy to you. It won't still be exceeding expectations. It will be frustrating for you as well as the company. So I think everybody got to ask this question: are you growing at the same rate or greater than the organization or than the team that you're on? And if the answer to that question is yes, then you should totally fight for being there, and I think you'll be rewarded because others will see that in you. But if you want to just latch on to the growth and be like, oh, I was there early, and so I should be rewarded to be there a lot longer, even though I was early, that's not true. As a founder of a company, I'll tell you for myself, I had to step aside because I wasn't in that position.
Love these honest conversations. You know, this is why I enjoy talking to you every time I get a chance. Amazing. Now let's look at this execution of the MOVE framework. Who are the stakeholders across the organization involved in ensuring great orchestration of this MOVE framework? More importantly, are these stakeholders only internal to the organization, or do investors also come into play?
Oh, that's a great question, Yark. When we looked at it, I honestly thought, go to market. CMOs probably are going to say that they own it. Or maybe the CROs will be the one who would say, well, we own revenue. We actually should be owning it. But the reality is the CEO owns it. And it was a big learning for me. Truly. I don't know if you just add, I'm just turning the recording back on you. Did you recognize that the CEO owns it, or was that a new revelation for you too?
In a typical startup, I would understand, but in a mid-sized organization, if you say that the CEO owns, and especially listening to Brian's case, I was surprised.
Yeah, right. And it was echoed through the industry. Netmeta, CEO of Gainsight, they're again similarly 100 million in revenue. They just hit that this year, 100 million in revenue. Same thing. Not as big as HubSpot, but quite big. For that many, same thing at Outreach. Our own at Terminus, 50 million plus in revenue, same thing. So it is if you go from startup all the way to IPO public stage, we have gone through so much research on this book. Like, that's really honestly what I'm most proud of, is the research that has gotten into this book. And it has been echoed over and over again. But again, as Brian said, this is the most unsexy part of the business. This is not what you talk about on a stage. This is the sausage making of the company. Like, this is what happens in the boardrooms. That's what happens in the executive team meetings and stuff.
And this is the topic in marketing where we have the least number of books as well.
Yeah, you're right. Like, this is, and to me, this is using Jeffrey Moore's proverbial crossing the chasm. To me, I had to cross the chasm by writing this book. Like, I'm not writing this for a marketer. I had to literally say that to myself. I'm writing this for a marketer who wants to understand go-to-market, but not this. The ideal person who should have this book should be the CEO and the executive team. So I look at this as, like, I don't look at going in front of 3,000 people and doing a keynote for this book. Like, it probably won't make any sense. I want to be able to go in a room of 12 people, the executive team run by the CEO, saying, hey, we need to understand our go-to-market. We need to figure out what process we're following. We need to figure out what stage of the business we are in. We need to figure out our next move. And I'm committed for this executive team to drive our business forward, and let's work on this together. Now, that's the conversation what this book will help companies do. So to me...
Is it account-based keynote then?
It is very much account-based keynote. It's like 12 people room keynote.
Right. Yeah, so back to the set of people who are focused on orchestrating this.
Yeah, so we wrote down in the book four different personas, because these are the four people that I felt, as we did the research, and Brian and I, when we went through all of this, were the four most influential people in the company, around the company, that actually brings it. But we also had to define their roles, because a lot of times in an early stage company, somebody might overstep what their role is. So here are the four roles. This is for the investors, for the CEOs. We already said the CEOs are the owners, the CMOs and the CROs. So the investors, we call them the guide. They are the one who are supposed to bring in more of the pattern matching and center of excellence around go-to-market. Hey, here's what we see. Here's what your stage company does. Here's what, here are the CEOs that we want to connect with you. Their job is to be the guide. Now, this is where a lot of times early stage investors might overstep and try to take over and tell the CEO and the team, you should do this. You should go in this market. No. That's a big problem. That's like really not a good idea. So investors, your job is to be the guide. CEOs, I think we've already established that your job is to really own it and be clear to your team that you own it. Like, there is no if, and, or buts around it. You own it. CMOs, any marketer listening to it, or a CMO is listening to do this, your job is to be the galvanizer. Now, you like, really, CMOs, you have access to all this information. You see all the stuff happening around you. Anyway, if anything goes wrong, it is always the marketer's fault in a company, right? We don't sell much. Market is not doing something. The product is not sticking. Market is not making a stick. So you already are anyway the center of the punch bag out there anyway. So your job could be to galvanize everybody and ask the tough questions. We, in the book, we provide the 9 questions for each stage of the business to help you to strategically transform your business, to align your executive team on it, and ask the question around, okay, if you're in problem market fit, what questions you should be asking to get your executive team to align. So you need to galvanize this internally. So that's what CMOs are called to do. And then CROs, look, if you really are a CRO, which means you should have sales and customer success reporting into you, not just a glorified CRO which only has sales reporting to you. That makes no sense.
So right.
If you have sales and customer success, that means you own the entire revenue stream for your business, and then you are the orchestrator. You are the one who is saying, all right, here's how we're going to orchestrate. We're not going to go after enterprise right now. We're going to focus on mid-market because we need to brew a retention rate for this segment or this cohort based on your stage. So you get to orchestrate this because you see the 2 areas of your top line revenue and bottom line and the revenue coming in. So those are the 4 most influential roles when it comes to go-to-market.
Wow. Sangram, how long did you take to research on this? Because this seems to be super thorough. I don't know how many people you spoke to and how many organizations you went and saw how things are working. How long did it take?
I mean, I used COVID, quite honestly, to just do this. Like it's been a year and a half of actual writing of the book and editing of the book and stuff. But quite frankly, I mean, this is what I have seen being at Pardot, getting through the acquisition of ET and Salesforce, being at Salesforce, and then also starting Terminus, and now getting to towards 50. We're realizing that, man, I've gone through the valley of death like 7 times, right? the number of companies I'm on the board of, or I'm an advising CEOs. Like, I feel like this is the conversation especially in the last 5 years, I've had numerous times as part of just building company and advising companies. So I think the book has been just in the makings. And again, I do believe that all we really have tried to do is to give common vocabulary around stages of business and the questions that companies are already, leaders are already asking and saying, it is okay to be in the stage you're in, but there are different metrics and there are different motions that you need to play in order to be successful in that stage, in order to transform your business to the next stage. And I see a lot of people just skip that. And I hope this book provides them as a guide.
Absolutely. I would tell all my listeners here that, you know, this book would save you at least a good 7 to 8 years of experience if you can use this as a blueprint. Because, you know, what I have taken out of this book is probably I knew only about 50% of what this book has covered, and that I learned it over the last 13 years. So there is so much that this book can save. So thank you so much for this, Sangram.
Anytime, Yag. And again, thanks for your kind words, man. It's definitely... I'm really proud of the book, not because I've written it, it's with Brian, but it's more the research that has gone in the book. I really feel that it is very cross-sectional, and it will be of help for any stage of the business, not by saying by broad brush, like, hey, this is a book for everybody. It really gives you, if you're in that, you will be able to very quickly figure out what stage you're in, and what metrics you need to focus on, and what scorecard you should look at, and what questions you should be asking. And that itself, hopefully, is worth the price of the book.
Absolutely. All right, so now that we are towards the 40-minute mark in the podcast, that means we are now moving to the next section, which we call the rapid-fire section. So I'm going to put 5 lightning questions at you, and see if I can put you on the spot by asking some tricky questions. So are you ready for that?
Let's go.
All right. So here's question number 1. What, according to you, is more meaningful for an evangelist? Is it the love for the product or the passion about the idea or the problem itself that you're solving for?
Well, you know the answer to that question that I have, right? Like it's the problem. It is ultimately the problem that drives everything. I don't remember how many times I've talked about Terminus, but I'm mostly talking about the problem we solve.
Right. So sometimes I think that, hey, you know, you can be passionate about the problem, but at the same time, that passion needs to reflect in you building the product as well. So it goes 50-50. Would you agree with that?
It depends. The depends on the audience. I feel like I look at it as that our audience, when you think about it externally, it should be all about the problem, because that's really what brings people into it. People who have similar problems will get attracted to that. Now, when you're in a closed room, when you're with your customers, when you are like pitching to one-on-one to a customer or set of people, of course, it needs to translate to saying that, hey, the problem we talk about, we truly so believe that we're building a product that attempts to solve that problem. And even that vocabulary is so important to say that you're attempting to solve it, to recognize that there are some problems that are hard and it takes time and they might need more than your product to solve the problem. So falling in love with the problem is 10 times more important than the product. And here's another thing about this, Yang. Your product can change. Your product will change in most cases because of this whole idea of from problem to product to platform, which means you now have more than one product. So if you get tied too strongly with the product and wouldn't have the almost the audacity to understand that the problem is bigger than the product, then you will never be able to build a big enough platform to solve that problem. Because if your product solves the problem, then you're thinking too small.
That makes a lot of sense. Love that answer. All right, so here's question number two. What's your best memory of being marketed to you without even realizing that you're being marketed to?
I love when this was in the early days of videos. Now everybody does videos. But in the early days of videos, somebody sent me a video saying that, hey, I made this video for you around one of the articles I've written. So, of course, I'm opening it. Because, you know, who doesn't want to know, like, what you wrote on my article? Right. Like, what is it? And so I read it. I saw what they did there. Then I went and looked at their profile. And obviously, you get, you know, alerted on LinkedIn. And you go to somebody's profile, you can see that. So in many ways, I spent 10 minutes on that person, on the stuff. And then looked at what that person did. And I felt like, oh, when was the last time I actually did spend 10 minutes on somebody's outreach? So I thought that was really well done, and I think it allowed me to know more about them without they soliciting that information. So I was more open to having a conversation with that person because they did the work to get to know me first.
Wow, that's an interesting story. Amazing. So question number three is going to be a little tricky. Let's say you won a free spot to hang a billboard at the heart of Times Square or Madison Avenue, where your ad will be seen by, say, thousands of high-profile business professionals. But if you could advertise only one thing on the billboard, is it going to be Terminus or Peak Community or Flip My Funnel podcast?
Ooh, wow. Wow, that is very, very tricky. If those are the only three options that I have, then I would promote the podcast. And here's why. You know, the thing is, if you can get into somebody's ears, you can get into somebody's hearts. And if they see value in it, they will keep listening to hundreds of, like, you know, we're about 1,000 podcasts now on Flip My Funnel. I get that almost every day, Yog. Somebody saying, you have no idea how much impact your podcast has done on me, on my career. I got promoted. I got a job. Like, I get these messages every day. I'm not saying this from a place of bravado. I'm saying this from a place of recognizing that when you put effort in building something of value, knowing that you have no idea who's listening to this, like literally no idea who's listening, but then somebody takes the effort to message you back on a regular basis, saying that, hey, that impact, that's like the goodwill that you put in the world. So I would do podcasts because it promotes Terminus, it promotes the community, gives value to people, and once you're hooked on a podcast, you will be listening to a lot more of those, so you're constantly in their hearts. Now, if you were just doing one or the other, the other areas, if you don't want to be part of a community, you're out. If you don't want to look into Terminus, you're out, and I really don't get to build a relationship with you then.
You know, that's an interesting choice. I knew you would have an interesting answer. And I 100% agree with you on the podcast idea because, you know, I have experienced that personally. You know, I get DMs where people write huge paragraphs where they say, yeah, I don't agree with what this person said because of this, this, this. And I'm like, you've spent so much time in explaining this. That means a lot to me.
Yeah, it is such a personal. It's one of those things that, you know, and a lot of times you can't even share that publicly because a lot of times so much of that is such a personal information that people would share. an impact, but that's what keeps, I think, people like you and me going.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. Right, so question number four. What's a great B2B marketing podcast other than yours that you can subscribe to and want to give a shout out to?
Well, I mean, I do love Sastr's Harry Stebbings podcast because it does bring in really, really candid conversations out there in the marketplace. So that is one area. Outside of that, I think there's a good friend of mine, Pat Lencioni, who wrote several books on leadership. His podcast is also very, very good, At the Table. I think I listen to At the Table more than Sastr.
Amazing. I'm going to check out these two podcasts. I've heard of Sastr, but the other one I haven't. So I definitely want to check that out. Right. So question number five, if you were to redo the Peak community from the start, what's one thing that you would change about it to make it better?
I think, and I've been actually thinking about this. So we're about 500 members now in the community. And we never really, you would never see us push around it. And we're literally thinking of stopping all new members coming in and having them go through a full-on qualification process. It's like 85 or 90% like retention rate in the community. It's really solid community. Like, people don't leave. People are engaged in events. People are trying to actually lead different events and stuff. Like, I feel like sometimes I'm hardly doing anything to help because there's just so much going on already in the community. So I think we're actually thought about it in the beginning, but I was too sheepish to do it. I think we're going to stop having people join the community just willy-nilly. Anybody can join. We were actually going to go have, by next year, we're thinking of changing it to say, from now on, either you have to be referred by somebody, so it is a completely referral-based, or you have to go through an application process.
You know, I would have never imagined you to say something like this, or any community owner to say something like this, because generally everybody's looking at how do I expand the community. But you know, I'm very happy that you said this, because the quality is important. And for me, the favorite part of the Peak community is that I pretty much have one-to-one relationships with a lot of people. And the best part is when you get to have these one-on-one calls that we do once a month. I think that's the most beautiful thing that you can get out of any community.
You absolutely are right. Like, and those are the things, which is why we never wanted this to be like, you know, some of those are like gone to 2,000 and only 20 people are engaged. Like, no, we like every week there are 10 plus members who join and they get engaged. Judd, for example, as you said, he does onboarding for every new member. Doesn't matter if you're in a Peak community, a general member, or in the emerging CMO or a CMO, he does onboarding every week for every single person. So we're creating a very white glove experience for everybody. And the reason we do that is because we're not looking for sponsorship. We're probably the only community that don't have sponsorships of anything. So we are doing everything possible to keep it vendor neutral, run by the community. Most of the events, you know, I'm not even running it. Like, there are people coming up with topics and running events. So we want to make this, making sure that this is a marketers community for marketers by marketers. And one of the things that we're recognizing is that, well, good marketers will attract better marketers. So why not just stop? Because we're not trying to make money here. We're trying to build a real tribe of great people together. That making money is not the goal of this community. So we're thinking of reimagining how we started and saying, how about we just change the way people get into this community?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know what? You have hit all these five questions out of the park, and you did amazingly well in the rapid fire section.
Thank you so much. I was crossing my fingers for that one, so glad I passed.
This is so much fun. And you know, once again, thank you so much, Sangram, for spending so much amount of time and sharing about the book in detail. But before I say my goodbyes and thank you for the day, I would like to ask you, is there a parting message that you would like to share with our audience?
You have heard me probably say this before, and I say that a lot more now than to myself, which is being intentional is way more important than being brilliant. And I look at everything in life right now, and I see things now differently, as obviously as we grow in our life and careers and family, and we recognize that, man, being brilliant is so overrated. Having the greatest, smartest idea is so overrated. And I look at everything that I'm able to do today, if anything of good has come out of it, has always been when I've been more intentional about it. Might as well be the book, might as well be the business, might as well be my own personal life and family and kids. So, there was a parting message that is far beyond valuable than the book that I would love to have everybody subscribe to is this idea of just whatever you have passion for, whatever is the gift of God that you have, just be intentional about it. Put your head down, focus on it, for a good year, 2 year, might as well be a decade. And when you lift up your head and see the world, you will see that you are way ahead in the race, whatever race you are. You're not even part of the race at that point. You're way ahead of the league. And that's something that I'm definitely recognizing I need to do more.
That's such a powerful message. If I have to put it in three words, I would say intention keeps you in contention.
Love that. Love that.
Absolutely. And if the listeners of the podcast, if they want to find you, connect with you, what are the best reasons they can connect with you and what should they not disturb you for?
Well, here's what we talked about the podcast. So here's the challenge. Yeah. Hit up Yog and I on LinkedIn. One thing that you got out of that podcast, of this episode, let us know what you loved or got excited and let us know. And I'll send you a signed copy of the book if you do so. How about that?
That's amazing. People, if you're listening to this, this is your time to get a signed copy from Sangram, and it doesn't get any better. I'm loving this book and I'm sure this would be your Bible if you're going to be, building your marketing organization. And even if you're going to start up an organization or do anything, this book is going to be that blueprint. So thank you once again, Sangram. Really, really appreciate your time and love this book so much. And I'm going to at least buy a few more copies and share it with some of my friends to whom I think they should definitely read this book.
Thank you, man. And I think you already know this, but all the proceeds for the book goes to New Story Charities for this year. So the more the better. We just crossed about $6,500 in the first week and a half of it. So it's definitely doing really well. And I would love for this to do even better, especially for the new story.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw that, I was listening to that conversation and I was also listening to that smart homes for, people who are homeless. So that's a fantastic initiative.
Yes. Awesome, man. Thank you so much for helping them.
All right, then. So for the listeners of the podcast, that's that from us in this episode. And until we connect with you the next time with another guest and another topic, this is bye from me, Yag. Have a good day and take care.
Thanks for listening to the ABM Conversations Podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share your comments with us. We're constantly looking for your feedback, thoughts, and suggestions to make the show more relevant to you.